whole time. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Stephen Gervin. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
It's 2:41 on the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. In sports this afternoon, a U of I football player has been charged with two counts of felony aggravated battery after a bar fight that authorities say sent another man to the hospital. 19-year-old Mike Garrity of Batavia has pleaded not guilty to charges stemming from the Friday fight at Cam's near campus. Police say women at the bar told Garrity the unidentified man harassed them. The Champaign County State's Attorney, Julia Reed, says Garrity punched him, fracturing the man's skull. Reed says the man is a university student and remains hospitalized today. The Toronto Blue Jays will try to wrap up a four-game sweep of the White Sox today in Toronto. The Blue Jays will aim for their 10th straight victory at Rogers Centre against the White Sox and their 14th in the last 16 overall in the series. Toronto has scored Chicago 38-19 this season and winning 5 of 6 meetings so far. The St. Louis Cardinals will try to avoid being swept when they face the Brewers in Game 3 of their series tonight. That's in St. Louis. Kyle Loesch is scheduled to take the mound for St. Louis. He'll be trying to bounce back from a pair of rough starts. He started the season 3-0 with a 1.97 ERA. Since then, he's gone 0-2, and his ERA has jumped to 11.32. The Cubs get a rest today. They'll open a 3-game series in St. Louis tomorrow night. The Cubs are 21-15 so far this season. They're in second in the National League Central, just ahead of St. Louis, a game and a half behind Milwaukee. The NFL pension plan for coaches is likely to be one of the topics at this week's owners' meeting. Commissioner Roger Goodell and the owners are likely to be questioned about changes in the plan for coaches after two longtime Colts assistants retired last week rather than lose their benefits. The owners voted in March to make the pension, 401k, and current supplemental retirement plan non-mandatory for the clubs, and 9 teams have dropped the program. NFL Coaches Association Director Larry Kennan said the coaches were never notified of the change when it was voted on in March. And most World Series and AL Championship Series games will have an earlier start on Fox this year. The network says weeknight games will start just before 7 o'clock Central Time, more than a half hour before last year's first pitch times. The start of Saturday night games could be even earlier. Sunday games will continue to begin following the conclusion of the network's NFL coverage. And that's a look at sports at 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. There used to be things you could rely on in sports. The Red Sox would never win the World Series. No one would beat Mark Spitz's 7 gold medals and 1 Olympics. And rain would always ruin Wimbledon. Well, now you can scratch that last one off, too. The weather hasn't changed, but the All England Lawn Tennis Association has now built a retractable roof over Wimbledon's famous center court. NPR's Rob Gifford attended yesterday's opening of the closing of the roof.
Old traditions die hard on these rain-swept islands, even when it comes to keeping out the rain. But in the end, says the chief executive of the Lawn Tennis Association, Ian Ritchie, the decision to build a roof for centre court was a fairly easy one to make.
If you've got your lifetime ambition of getting a ticket to Wimbledon and then it rains, it's a huge disappointment. So there's the people here. And then secondly, we're in 185 countries around the world on television. Everybody would prefer to see live tennis. So on both counts, I think that's the major reason behind the roof.
To mark the first official closing of the roof, the club invited 1992 champion and longtime Wimbledon favourite Andre Agassi and his wife, 7-time champion Steffi Graf, to come and play. Their opponents, British favourite Tim Henman and Belgian star Kim Clijsters. Agassi, who once played a tie here that was spread over 5 days because of rain interruptions, agreed at a pre-match news conference that the roof was good for fans, for the sport, and also for the players.
To have an environment with no elements, I think, accentuates really the athlete and the skill sets that exist with players. No elements mean the better ball striker, the better athlete, no excuses. That's also pretty nice to watch.
On On a typically blustery English spring day, out on the court, Welsh diva Catherine Jenkins warmed up the 15,000-strong crowd, and then the roof was ceremonially closed.
The 87-year-old centre court has been transformed and now is ready to welcome a new era of champions, legends and epic matches.
It wasn't such an epic match that then unfolded. Just one set of mixed doubles, won by Henman and Clijsters, and one each of men's and women's singles, won by Agassi and Clijsters respectively. It was clear that Mr. and Mrs. Agassi still had plenty of the old zing in their ground strokes, though there was certainly more kissing and hand-holding in between games than Wimbledon is strictly used to. Some commentators have lamented the passing of the old, rainy centre court, saying that a covered court makes Wimbledon too much like the other Grand Slam events. But for most of the general public here, like Steve Plowman and his friend Anne McCulloch, lining up for their traditional glass of Wimbledon Pimm's, the roof was very popular.
It's a wonderful thing because it'll mean that Wimbledon can play tennis to its schedule and it won't have to cram games in. It's much better for players, much better for the spectators.
I think it's a good thing. I agree with everything Steve said. We travel about 150 miles to London to watch Wimbledon. I've been here and it's rained all day and we've seen no tennis.
And as if to vindicate the decision of the All England Lawn Tennis Association, right on cue as the games drew to a close, the heavens opened and it began to rain. Rob Gifford, NPR News, at the Centre Court in Wimbledon.
Voters in California will weigh in on six ballot measures tomorrow, all related to the state's troubled budget, and that could bring California ever closer to fiscal chaos, as John Myers of member station KQED reports.
When he was riding high in the polls a few years ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger enjoyed talk that maybe the Constitution would be changed so an immigrant like himself could be president. These days, the only part of the nation's capital he seems to long for is the printing press.
California does not have the pleasure of printing their own money. So if we would be Washington, you know, I would be printing more money. But that's not what is the case.
Instead, Schwarzenegger and the state legislature are now asking voters to ratify a series of painful and unpopular budget balancing proposals in a special election tomorrow. Those measures include a new formula to limit government spending, borrowing from the state lottery, and taking money earmarked for children and mental health. Polls show the proposals headed for defeat. They are unpopular with almost every subset of Californians. Even conservatives oppose the spending limit. They see it as akin to a Trojan horse because it's attached to a $16 billion tax increase.
It can be characterized as extortion for budget reform.
John Kupal is president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association.
You know, we will give you what you want, meaning budget reform, but you're going to have to pay a price that you really shouldn't have to pay.
Kupal says the focus should be more on spending cuts and efficiencies. Supporters argue that still won't bring in enough money, and they say the state needs the tax increase.
Without Props 1A and 1B, we have $16 billion in new cuts coming. Could lose another 24,000 firefighters and police. And you know who that hurts? The people who depend on us.
Political ads from the governor and his allies paint the election in the gravest of terms. And last week, more bad news, as the governor's budget advisors said California's deficit would grow to $21 billion by next summer if the ballot measures fail. On Thursday, Schwarzenegger even laid out two spending plans for the state, one if the ballot measures pass tomorrow, one if they fail. If they fail, he's proposing everything from the release of thousands of prison inmates to laying off firefighters, even as another hot, dry summer settles in. Critics say the governor is resorting to scare tactics. He says it's simply the truth.
I think that we owe it to the people of California to tell them what the consequences are so they know. And then they still have a choice to vote yes or no on those initiatives.
One of the governor's problems, though, is perception. 5 years ago, Schwarzenegger convinced voters to approve a balanced budget amendment that he said would solve California's fiscal problems. It didn't.
This is a man who does not have the soft sell in him. His entire life has been about selling things as big and over the top.
Joe Matthews is a former reporter who wrote a book on Schwarzenegger's early years as governor. Matthews says the one-time political neophyte has staked much of his reputation on finding a budget fix that California's divided electorate will accept.
I think the lesson that he's about to learn is that there's no broad constituency, no majority, no consensus for doing anything like that.
If so, talk that California is ungovernable will continue. And that cynicism could be fueled this autumn when it's projected the state will have less cash on hand to pay its bills than ever before. Now there's talk, quiet but perceptible, that California, with its huge economy and huge problems, may end up asking Congress and President Obama for a financial lifeline later this year. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
It's 2:50 on the Afternoon Magazine. Of the thousands of cases of swine flu worldwide, there have been only two confirmed cases of the H1N1 virus in China. Even so, one surprising group of people is feeling the economic impact of the flu outbreak, as Lisa Lim reports from Shanghai.
Spice prices in a dusty covered market in Shanghai may seem an unlikely barometer of the level of public panic about new pandemic flus. But one such spice is the silver bullet against swine flu, and before that, bird flu. It's the orangey-red, licorice-smelling, star-shaped pod called star anise. It's normally used in stews and five-spice powder. But as Cao Yong, spokesman for drug maker Roche, explains, there are only two ways to produce the active ingredient for the flu-fighting drug Tamiflu, and one of them depends on star anise.
One of the most important ingredients for Tamiflu is shikimic acid. This stuff can be developed from both dianese and also from the fermentation process in E. coli. That's the link.
30 pounds of star anise pods only produce 1 pound of shikimic acid, and 90% of the world's star anise is from China. 4 years ago, when bird flu was the next big pandemic threat, a star anise shortage caused bottlenecks in Tamiflu production. But Cao Yong says this time round, Roche has enough ingredients to avoid problems. To date, 220 million courses of Tamiflu have been ordered by governments. In China, ordinary shoppers are also using more star anise, partly because of this cooking tip, given at a press conference by none other than China's health minister, Chen Zhu.
So I suggest that we can cook the pork with star anise. This will be a very good option to deal with swine flu.
There is no scientific proof that this is true, and there's no known risk of flu from eating pork. Yet from the moment when swine flu broke out in Mexico, the price of star anise started to go up, says spice seller Huang Jinshan. He scoops up handfuls of the spice to weigh them. The retail price has soared 30% to about $1 a pound. But Mr. Huang is unimpressed. He remembers fondly the run on white vinegar 4 years ago, when a rumor went round that white vinegar could cure bird flu. To begin with, he says, one bottle of white vinegar cost about 20 cents. Within a fortnight, the price had increased 30-fold to $7 a bottle. Then the market collapsed completely. This time, he says, that's unlikely to happen, since there are fewer rumors. But, he admits, he is thinking about stockpiling star anise, just in case. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
Now we go closer to home. The Art Institute of Chicago has opened a new modern art wing, making it the second largest museum in the country. The $300 million addition was designed by the architect Renzo Piano, who was at the opening ceremony over the weekend.
Culture is not something that belongs to elite. Culture is about putting some light in your eyes, and it's about making life better.
Speaking of culture, this star's architect's design is the latest of many high-profile, often lavish museum expansions over the past two decades. One long-term goal is to revitalize local economies. To find out whether that's paying off, NPR's Renee Montaigne spoke with Bruce Altshuler, the director of New York University's Museum Studies Program.
Many cities, sort of following the example often cited of Bilbao, Spain, where Frank Gehry built a very dramatic museum for the Guggenheim, you know, are looking toward museums and cultural institutions as ways of bringing people back into urban centers and also attracting tourists.
Well, you know, just on that point, a number of museums are using named architects, which obviously ups the cost, ups the publicity. Wondering if it ups the appeal, the attraction, and actually the revenues.
Well, there's no question that museums have used the large dramatic buildings built by star architects as attractors. So I'm not really sure in terms of how effective this has been. I suspect it has been effective. Certainly when you read the newspapers and the art magazines, you see lots of attention being paid to the buildings. And, you know, again, architecture, though a functional form, certainly is in line with the sort of mission of art museums to kind of increase the visibility of visual art.
Although that brings up the perennial question of whether these new museums, maybe architecturally glamorous as they are, if they help the art, or even in some cases, do they outshine the art inside?
Well, I mean, there is an ongoing discussion, as you say, about architects designing for themselves and not for the display of the works in the museum. I think this varies according to the building. I mean, Piano is known as someone who designed buildings that highlight the art displayed there. One example often pointed to, of course, in the other direction is the Guggenheim Museum designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, you're going up a ramp, so you're standing on an incline. The walls are not completely vertical, so paintings have to be kind of put on false walls sometimes. You know, yes, I mean, I think many people thought that it was really an assertion of the ego of the architect over that of the artist.
Well, along with these expansions, museums have been raising ticket prices. At the Museum of Modern Art in New York, it's now $20. Are these higher ticket prices a function of these bigger ambitions? And beyond that, are they affecting attendance in a negative way?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that these larger new facilities prompt increased admissions. Now, how that affects attendance, you know, I don't really know. It would not surprise me if attendance went down to some degree. But museums are also working very hard to sort of raise money for sponsorship, for free evenings, free weekends. And I think there's a lot more effort going into that now that ticket prices have increased. There are quite a number of museums that continue to be free to the public. And oddly enough, many of these seem to be in the Midwest, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, all those art museums are free to the public. And there is something wonderful to just decide to go to a museum for 1 hour when you can walk in and see something and then walk out.
Bruce Altshuler is the Director of Museum Studies at New York University. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Renee.
And our last word in business today comes from another museum.
Earth and sky.
We expect by 2050, in about 40 years, for the demand for electricity in the United States to double.
You're listening to Carl Imhoff, an electrical engineer with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, located in Washington State. Imhoff's research is part of a multi-billion-dollar effort paid for with both public and private.